You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So first of all, many apologies for the fact there wasn't a show last week. I was sidelined due to a bereavement, which happily I've now run off. We're a week on now, and I'm from Stoke and not an East End gangster, so I'm ready to go again. All fine. You know, there'll be another mother along in a minute. but just to say, this is how pathetic I am, Chris, that I'm 6 years of age, really. I love my mother, and she was a Stoke fan as well.
Yes.
But when it said cause of death, stroke on the thing, I just couldn't help thinking, on mine, I'm hoping it's going to say cause of death, stoke. Because that's there's a good chance of that actually happening.
Yeah, and there's a good chance of Stoke being in all the boxes there. Place of death.
Yes, there actually is. Yeah, yeah. And the other good thing is it means that even though we've only been going for like about 20 weeks or something, we've already got a lost episode.
Yeah,
like Stepstone Son or Dad's Army.
Well, anyway, I feel sure we should be recycling quite a lot of it right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't go searching in Ian Lavender's attic for the script of last week. But anyway, so on with the comedy. So despite his misunderstanding of the phrase party politics, Boris Johnson is desperate to hang on in office until April, when all COVID restrictions will expire, because he's got this bitching leaving do planned. Apparently Cameron's coming and he's going to do the pig's head thing.
Well, other questions were raised over Boris Johnson's Downing Street party. Questions about security, propriety and honesty. But the biggest question seems to have been ignored. What the fuck is a man of 56 doing having a birthday party at all with a cake and singing, for the love of God?
And a suitcase of wine.
Is it? Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, if you should be a grown-up like Prince Andrew, who can have a birthday party with all of his teddies, and that way doesn't cause any problems whatsoever.
Exactly. And with some of his girlfriends who still have enough candles that you could fit them on a cake. But anyway, it was a week also in which news emerged that Elon Musk's old Falcon 9 rocket is on course to crash into the moon and explode, and Earth leaders are bracing for a declaration of war from the clangers. They're coming for our soup. They look tiny on the telly, don't they? But look at them in comparison to the size of the craters. They're fucking enormous.
They are big.
And they have armoured waistcoats. The only way to take them down is to snag them on something and hope they unravel.
Yeah.
That's my plan. That's my plot, anyway, for Independence Day 3.
Revenge of the Clangers.
Revenge of the Clangers.
That's a fantastic... I would go and watch that, definitely.
I would pay good money, especially if I'd written it. Anyway, before we move on to the sunlit uplands of the Premier League, where birds sing and goat herds yodel merrily, filled with the sheer joy of life, let us first pay a reluctant visit to that cold, dark, dank and dripping cave. You know, the one where Gollum lives. That is the very bottom of the EFL, which is where Oldham still find themselves now, 7 points adrift of Colchester with no games in hand. Colchester mutually sacked Haydon Mullins by Mullins, that's his name, isn't it? By
I like Mullins.
Mullins. Moulin Rouge, by mutual consent last week, and duly got their no-manager bounce, winning 3-0 away at Salford. We, on the other hand, were shipping three goals away at Harrogate Town. My friend Steve said it looked on the television like our defenders were wearing clown shoes, which is, I guess, one of the bonuses of having clowns in charge of your club. Access to outsized footwear, and being able to take the whole squad to away games in a single small car with an endearing and comical horn. I went to the game with our friend Howard and my son John, who is also, of course, our friend, which means I have now visited all 92 of the current league clubs. There are still 8 grounds to go, but they're all now new grounds where I've done the old one. That's Spurs, Brighton, Wimbledon, Middlesbrough, Man City, Morecambe, West Ham and Cardiff. It was a good trip, apart from the 3-0 thing and the bloke who stood very close behind me murmuring, "Oh, good ball, and go on now, run with it," in my ear, like we knew each other really well. Like an inexplicable lack of respect for personal space. He kept clapping right in my ear as well. And he was stood so close to me that to get his hands up to clap by my ear, he kept whacking me on the back of the head. And I moved at half-time, of course.
I think he was coming on to you, Chris. doubt about it. Yeah. That sexy, sexy Fenella Fielding voice
in
your ear.
Yeah, he went off the idea in the second half. Because at half-time, he went to the toilet and left a little satchel behind and I had a dump in it. Anyway... Actually,
that could well have been what he was after all along.
Anyway, Oldham bossed the game, believe it or not, possession-wise, for what that's worth. But a lot of that possession was spent just trying to get the ball past the halfway line after the idiotic goal kick routine that we do, that I've mentioned before, knocking it 6 feet across the mouth of our own goal. I mean, fair enough, if the keeper does knock it long, there's nobody to win it because we have no strikers, only incompletely converted midfielders playing out of position. But it felt like a tipping point, actually, like we couldn't possibly go on like this any longer. And sure enough, while we were sitting in a pub at Sheffield Station, waiting to put Howard on the train back to London, Oldham's owner said, thanks very much to our interim Tunisian with his 0% win ratio and his Red Sea haircut, and announced that he was accepting the eye-wateringly generous offer from John Sheridan, our 4-time previous boss, to take over for nothing, for no money, because he loves the club and it's breaking his heart to see how far we've fallen. So bless him. Shez, as he calls himself, he actually released a message to the fans this week on his arrival, which began... Hello, it's John Shez here. He calls himself John Shez.
Excellent.
And he has previous. I mean, twice before, he's come in January with relegation from League One at the time, staring Oldham in the face, and pulled us out of trouble. Events that have become known as the Shezurrections. Because of the revival in form, not because we're pleased to see him, although, of course, we are. I fear, of course, that on the third resurrection, they will roll away the stone and find the corpse of Oldham Athletic still lying in the cave, dead as a doornail hammered through the head of a dodo. But still, it's going to be interesting, because the last time Shez left, it was because of an acrimonious fallout with Mo Lemsigam, the owner's brother, who he installed as sporting director, about all the French fourth division rejects that kept turning up in his squad without his say-so. At least that won't happen this time, thanks to Brexit. Yeah, cheers, Boris. So bring it on. Shez erection 3. This time, it's probably terminal.
Well, you know, I think there's already been a bounce, because, to correct me if I'm wrong, but you've signed a player this week, haven't you?
Oh, have we?
Yeah,
we signed a couple last week. We signed Christopher Misilu back, who was our midfielder a couple of years ago, and he was decent.
And from Sheffield Wednesday,
Alex Hunt from Sheffield Wednesday. And as long as he doesn't get distracted by the arrival of puberty, then we should be fine. But we actually lost out on the two strikers we've so far been linked with. One went to Gloucester City. And the other to Ilkeston Town. Are they offering more money than we are in the league, or are we just such a shit show that they can't?
I don't think it's the money, Chris. I think it's the glamour. That's what they're going for there. Yeah.
Gloucester. Glamorous Ilkeston. Gloucester. There you go. They could have it as a nickname, couldn't they? I mean,
Go on. No, all I was going to say was to add to, I told you about the Wolves season ticket holder who now just refers to Oldham as we all the time. And on Saturday, I was at Stoke Fulham game and I was just walking along, you know, outside, going to my turnstile, my personal turnstile, obviously.
Of course.
And
the celebrity turnstile.
Yes, that's right. With just me, they're going through it. And Jeremy Bates.
Yes.
It's Shah. And anyway, that's enough. And as I was walking along, somebody went past me and just said in passing, "Go on, Oldham."
That's fantastic.
It's fantastic. It is.
That makes
isn't
me
it?
Happy. That
it's becoming
happy.
Like it. Yeah. It was like a spy encounter. You know, nobody actually saw us touch
your
or anything
language.
Like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But something was passed on.
That is fantastic. I mean, talking about the non-league, there is of course a lot of money swilling around in non-league compared to the bottom of the AFL too. National League Wrexham. Did you see this? Signed Ollie Palmer from AFC Wimbledon for £300,000. We haven't spent that much on a player since the 1990s. And he scored on his Wrexham debut against Grimsby in front of 8,500 people.
Wow.
I mean, that obviously is, you know, that's the Deadpool money kicking in. Their new owners, the Hollywood duo, of course, the Marvel superhero and the sitcom star. You know, I'm hoping we can get Scarlett Johansson and Ted Danson to buy Oldham. That's what I'm hoping for. You know, good luck with that, England. Anyway, did you see, apparently now the taxpayers own 8% of Bolton.
By which you mean me and you?
Yeah, exactly. It's because they took a $5 million emergency pandemic loan, and it was converted into shares as part of the terms of the deal because they didn't pay it back. So when Oldham drop out of the league, if the shares erection doesn't come to pass, who knows? It might be like one of those QAnon predictions. Then I can support 8% of Bolton. At least I could in seasons where I earned enough money to pay any tax. I mean, 8% is like one player. So I'm going to support Owen Doyle.
Okay.
Anyway.
Do you get shirt naming rights then? You did used to be able to sponsor a player, didn't you?
You still can. I think it's one of the sorriest pages in the Oldham programme is the one the page of players with the sponsors underneath where you can sponsor the shirt, the shorts, the socks. And I think we've got like two players have their socks sponsored by some local fucking charity shop. Yeah. You know, and the rest is all blank. I don't want to associate myself with any of these fuckers.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's sadder. I know many times you meet me at other programmes and nearly everybody's been sponsored except for two players.
Yeah.
And that's even sadder.
Because
they're thinking, what's wrong with me?
Well,
pair of socks.
And you were saying about Christopher Misselou arriving. He's one of the ones who's got his socks sponsored just last week. But the ones who've been there all season, fuck them. But anyway, moving on. There was a development yesterday. Did you see in one of the main stories that we missed out on last week, which was the controversial postponement of the North London Derby under the COVID protocol because Arsenal reckoned they didn't have enough first team players to compete. Of the players missing, only Martin Odegaard actually was unavailable because of COVID. They had four players at the AFCON. They had various injuries. They had Granit Xhaka suspended, but instead of sticking in some youngsters and getting on with it, Mikel Arteta went to the Premier League and asked for a postponement and ticking the piss, basically. I mean, the COVID rule said that a club could request a postponement if they didn't have 13 available outfield players and a goalkeeper. And it was obvious that they were starting to abuse this, that the managers started to pick and choose and only play big games if they had the strongest team available. And now that rule's been changed. So you have to have at least four now, COVID cases. You can still, you know, you can still count injuries as part of your squad thinning.
It was infuriating and an extremely charmless thing for them to do. To tell you the honest truth, it was terrible. Especially as this is a team who regularly get to at least the semi-final of the League Cup by playing all their young players.
Yeah, yeah.
And their young players are there. They're in the squad. They're happy to sell them for several million pounds
or loan them to Arnhem or whatever.
Exactly. So, and you just wonder if they've ever heard of Bert Trautmann. Some of these players have they ever heard about a man who played in a cup final with a broken neck
wouldn't come off. Yeah, yeah.
And wouldn't come off.
Couldn't come off. There wasn't anyone to come on.
And he said, shake your head if you want to come off. I can't. Anyway, you know, great heroes like that. I found that appalling and reprehensible.
It was terrible, particularly for those of us who you know have nothing left in our lives apart from watching the Sunday football on the television and pretending. Now that we've started doing this, that it's work. And so, you know, the Arsenal Spurs thing, that was a big miss in my Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Still. Yeah. Anyway, I think, Nick, we both wanted to talk about the AFCON, the African Cup of Nations, a little bit. Of course, that the whole thing was overshadowed rather on Monday evening by the terrible tragedy that happened there. People crushed to death, kids trying to get into the game between the hosts Cameroon and the outsiders Comoros. Just a terrible thing. I mean, more people trying to get in than had tickets. You know, and you wonder, don't you, whether they see that happening in the Euros, you know, at the Wembley, loads of people trying to get in without tickets, stewards being paid £9 an hour and able to do anything to stop them. And you think, you know, partly you think we were lucky no one was more seriously hurt. then, but yeah. what a terrible thing.
Well, it is absolutely terrible, and I just get the taste sometimes that there's a sense of this is a country far away of which we know little, and you know these sort of things happen, and I just think that's so untrue. I think you know the idea that some sort of contributory negligence is lazy, and it offers a way out from being compassionate and I think possibly racist too.
Well, it's exciting, you know, it's excitement, and you want excitement. It comes from people being excited to see the games, and you want, you know, you want that, but there yes. is a responsibility to steward these things properly, you know, and I don't know what else could have been done because I don't know enough about it. But
yeah,
you know.
But it's still a tournament under the auspices of FIFA, and FIFA has some responsibility to say,
which we'll come to. But anyway, as for the football itself, you know, that game, the Cameroon Comoros game, it turned out to be just a terrific spectacle, didn't it? I mean, the hosts and the favourites against the first time outsiders. I mean, I have to say, in the spirit of picking a team to follow, that I picked Comoros. Partly as the tiniest of underdogs, but partly because one of their players, Youssef Mchangamana, used to play for Oldham when we played Liverpool in the Cup 9 years ago. I mentioned this, didn't I? You just reminded me on Life Goals, Theo Delaney's podcast.
Yeah,
which is excellent. You should pick, you know, not just mine, you should pick, just look at all of them. But Mchangamana crossed the ball in the second minute for Matt Smith to open the scoring, and he was giving the Liverpool right midfielder a terrible time. He got taken out with a terrible tackle, just like an obvious red card, career-ending sort of tackle, you know, but not given. And the midfielder was Raheem Sterling. And Mchangamana never played for Oldham again, partly because his recovery just took longer than his contract. I mean, and he's been bobbing around the lower divisions in France ever since. He's at Guingamp, if that's how you say it.
Guingamp.
Dangon. Anyway, last week, Comoros, who'd never got a point or a goal in the tournament before, beat Ghana 3-2, knocking out the Black Stars, four times winners, World Cup quarterfinalists, one of the biggest shocks in the AFCON history. And it was terrifically exciting. Did you know that Comoros' nickname is the Coelacanths?
That's fantastic.
I think all the good nicknames were taken. The Indomitable Lions and the Super Eagles and the
nicknames themselves are fantastic.
They are. One of the teams, I think, is Equatorial Guinea, I think, are called National Thunder, which I think is fantastic. Whereas the Coelacanth, of course.
Wasn't Elizabeth Taylor in that?
Yes, I think she was, with some sort of gastric disorder. But the Coelacanth, of course, is known as its own nickname is the Living Fossil. Because it can live to 100 years and has the longest known gestation period of any creature. Not that this is relevant to the football particularly, but it was thought to have become extinct 66 million years ago until one popped up in the 30s. And they only swim around the Comoros Islands, Mary, which is off the coast of Mozambique.
And given the fact that this is Comoros' first tournament, despite the fact football's been played there for many years, the 100-year gestation period is actually kind of relevant, to tell you the honest truth.
Yeah, they've got a 5-year gestation period.
Oh, damn it. Now, I want to put you to my theory here. Oh, yeah. So I was looking at the last 16, who's qualified for the last 16, and indeed, who qualified for the whole thing. And below the equator, you only had Malawi and the Comoros Islands. And the Comoros Islands are the only team that border the east of Africa. So you've got the north of Africa where you've obviously got your Egypt and Morocco, blah, 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 blah. And then the rest of them are all in that arsey bit of the rhino, as I like to think of it. There's about 12 teams there that have all qualified for the last 16, all bang on next to each other. And so the theory is, and I've read a book about sport in the world, this is because a lot of the sports were basically exported by sailors, and they couldn't get to the east of Africa as easily as they could get to the west of Africa. So obviously all of those countries there were hit first, and football's been played there an awful lot more. And it's the same if you go to South America, where the big footballing playing countries are on the eastern seaboard.
The easiest to reach from Europe.
Yes, exactly. And I just thought it was rather fascinating to tell you the honest
truth. Well, the Comoros were French, weren't they, originally? They got independence from France.
Yeah, yeah.
So there were French sailors who were obviously, you know, not as adventurous as some of the others.
Well, no, because a lot of the countries on the other side were Francophone countries. Yeah. It's not about that. It's about the amount of trade that went.
Yeah, yeah.
More than anything.
No, it's interesting. As a Comoros Islands before football, before we signed Changamar, actually, I had no idea they even existed between Mozambique and Madagascar. Tiny little islands. Mm-hmm. And in the last 16, they played Cameroon, you know, who are one of the giants of Africa, although I don't think that's their actual nickname. They're the indomitable lions, aren't they? I think.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, yeah. And they went into the game with a really newsworthy disadvantage, didn't they? Because they had no goalkeeper because of COVID and injury. And if they'd been at the Euros, they'd have been able to call up another one if Comoros have more than three goalkeepers. But they had left-back El Hadour went in goal. And from the start. And he had, did you see the shirt that he had? He had the number 16 spare goalie shirt with his own number 3 painted on the back over the top.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Over the top of
the
number 16.
And did well.
He didn't have any kind of practice warm up before the game at all. Nothing. None of the sort of, you know, taking a couple of catches before. None at all. You know, I love the outfield player in goal thing. I think it's a great loss from football. I remember going to see Oldham at Leicester back in 2009, and our keeper got sent off while giving away a penalty, and Dean Windass went in goal. You remember him? He's right at the end of end of his playing career. And I'd been looking at him for the first. It was this about after about 10 minutes, and I'd been looking at him for the first 10 minutes, thinking, "Bloody hell, I'm faster than you." he looked terrible. But then, if you'd said after 9 minutes, this man's going to be man of the match. You know, no one would have believed you. But the penalty was missed, completely missed the goal. I think the kicker was just thrown by how very wide Windass seemed to be and misjudged what he would have to do to miss him. And it was a 0-0 draw and he stopped everything. And it was great. I mean, you know, Leicester were top of League One by a mile and we were nowhere as usual. And it was great. It was great. A 0-0 draw with 10 men and Dean Windass in goal.
Oh, so joyful. I remember us playing Luton and drawing 4-4, and we had 3 different keepers in that game. Peter Fox was sent off. Derek Parkin went in goal. Paul Bracewell saved a penalty. It was just fantastic.
Yeah.
Dog on the pitch. And the great thing about this Comoros game was that, you know, it wasn't a series of goalkeeping errors that decided it.
No.
They had an early sending off. It was just a rip-roaring, exciting, unexcited game of football.
It was. It was fantastic. And he made some brilliant saves, actually, the left back. He got undone a couple of times just by where a goalkeeper might have been ready for what happened. But actually, as a shot stopper, he was fantastic. He did a fantastic double save at one point. And Cameron were 2-0 up. Comoros came back to 2-1 with as good a free kick as you could possibly see from my lad Yusuf from Changamar. I mean, really, James Ward-Prowse would have it on his show reel. You know, no problem. And it was nearly an even bigger shock than the one they'd pulled off. Just fantastic cup tie football.
And just to wrap up a couple more things from the AFCON. I mean, I think there's been lots of joyful things in it. Group phases, it doesn't matter what tournament it is, and never as exciting. But that's fun. But I little things that I saw. I love the fact that the pitch side interviewer, you know, we're so used to everybody being so professional, for want of a better phrase, pitch side interviewer when I think it was Nigeria played Egypt, and he was obviously sent out to get an interview with Mohamed Salah, but it was still in the background, him sort of trying to get Salah. He gets Salah in the background and then gets a selfie with him, which is a great thing before doing the interview. And you just think, great, that's good, that's joy, that's, you know, that's excitement. And I also thought, because you reminded me of this, something we both laughed about before, of the great Cameroon song from the...
Pam Pam Cameroon.
Because of course they we always do World Cup songs, don't we, before you get there.
Yeah,
Cameroon did their World Cup song in 1990 after the World
Cup.
About the World Cup. And it's one of the great, great songs,
I
think.
Great...
We could do probably a verse each. I know that... they did each game. I know they played Colombia, if you remember.
Yeah.
And the verse on that one is, next team they play is Colombia. They got a damn fool goalkeeper.
Yes.
Try and take the ball around Roger Miller.
See him trying to dribble past Roger Miller.
Yeah.
See Miller laugh as he scored the winner.
Now the Lions, they play Russia, don't need to win, so they play at Rasta. Yeah. Lose 4-0, but it doesn't matter. great
there's
idea.
The great bit about when Cameroon lose to England, there's just a long sequence where the singer, it's the Maccabees, isn't it? Where the singer just goes, against the Cameroon, England were lucky, lucky, they were lucky, lucky, it was luck, they were lucky. And I thought, applied to Cameroon actually on Monday night. But still.
Yeah. I thought that was Kylie Minogue. Lucky.
Oh yeah. No, maybe. Ah, it's so long ago. Yeah. When there could still, of course, be a Sadio Mane versus Mo Salah final. That's still on. And even more good news for Africa. FIFA President Gianni Infantino suggested that a biennial World Cup would help save the lives of African refugees. He said, we need to give hope to Africans so they don't need to cross the Mediterranean in order to find maybe a better life, but more probably death in the sea. Which is an incredible thing to say, isn't it? Isn't that an incredible thing to say?
That's staggering.
Yeah, I mean, there were some good responses to it. Andrew Strolheim of Human Rights Watch said that African migrants, as far as he knew, never mentioned the timing of World Cup tournaments. And Ronan Evain of the Football Supporters Europe called it instrumentalising death in the Mediterranean to sell his megalomaniac plan, which I
liking
think
that
nailed.
Yeah.
There you
yeah.
are.
I love the idea that you are potentially an economic or a migrant or indeed a fleeing war or poverty or whatever it is, and then you've got it all set up with your family and you're about to go out the door and you go, hold on. It's France versus Belgium. We're not going now.
We're not going now. We can't go now. We've got to,
yeah. And tomorrow there's another one. Anyway,
we're going to work on the World Cup song. Well, I suppose, yeah, last time there was an international break on the horizon, we talked about how club owners see this, didn't we, as a perfect time to make a change and that it was called the killing time. With another one hoving into view and a soon-to-be-closing transfer window as well, there's inevitably been some twitchy knee-jerkery. And last week, Rafael Benitez reached the end of his uncomfortable time at Everton. Now, for the last few weeks, the cameras have been picking out a banner among the Everton fans. You've seen it. Benitez, get out of our club. And now, of course, he has done. I find that banner incredibly graceless and uncompromising. And you just know, don't you, that those blokes are swaggering around now. They're heroes, you know. At us, we got rid of Rafa. Yeah, get lost with your credentials and your tactics and your Champions League and your trophies and your respect from the international football community. We don't want your kind here.
Well, not only that, I mean, they're pumped up. They're now also starting to demonstrate against possible new managers.
Yes, well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the banner first was recycled into sack the board. Did you see that? It was the same thing, but the letters got smaller and smaller as they ran out of gaffer tape.
sack the board,
as if they know what difference sacking the board would make, as if they know who any of the fuckers are or what they do, you know. And they're and they're turning attention also to Bill Kenwright, as though everything is his fault. And it must be hard for him, as he's brought Mashiri along to try and, you know, match the other clubs, and he's genuinely a fan, and he seems like a nice bloke, and he wants what's best for the club. Fucking hell, you know, leave him alone.
I mean, Bill Kenwright is Everton through and through. He absolutely loves the club. He's so passionate. I mean, if you're going to blame him for something, blame him for Blood Brothers, you know, but not what's happening at Everton.
Bill Kenwright seems to me to be, whatever else you know about him or hear about him, and I haven't heard anything bad, he's just the sort of bloke you want in charge of your club, isn't he? Isn't he just the sort of bloke you want? I mean, compared to, you know, the Glazers, for instance, you know, you don't even believe would be able to name the full squad, you know, from a lineup. You know, Bill Kenwright is a dyed-in-the-wool Everton. Leave him alone, for Christ's sake. There were no banners I noticed about Farhad Mashiri, who's the one who seems to be playing Football Manager like a dad who can't understand how he's losing to his kids. You know, get out of our club, Mashiri, with your £500 million investment and your brand-new stadium on a World Heritage site. You know, there's not none of that. But there was, as you said, there was. The word early in the week was that Vitor Pereira, formerly of Porto, was the favourite ahead of Lampard and Rooney. And he's won the league in three different countries. And then some graffiti appeared at Goodison Park saying, Pereira out, Lampard in. You know, what's wrong with these people? You know, you see, you do what one of their banners says, and suddenly they think they can make all your decisions for you in big writing. You know, mm-hmm. But does big writing represent the views of the majority or just like a noisy, cretinous minority? I mean, people are taking notice, though, of that tactic. Apparently graffiti's appearing in Kiev that says NATO out, Russia in. You know, and you know, the thing that struck me about that protest, you know, after the Villa game when Duncan Ferguson was in charge, the protest afterwards with the new banner and the Kenwright ones and it was really quite small, really a very small percentage of people stayed for it, you know, and do they want, and you wonder, do they want Lampard? Because if he loses a few games, they won't feel as bad about making a Lampard get out of our club banner as they would making a Rooney one.
Yeah, you know? Well, I think that's interesting.
It's just pre-bannering is what they're doing.
I noticed that Lampard's aligned himself with Sir Alex Ferguson this week. You know, he wants to get his credentials out there. And so he got off a driving ban through Mr. Loophole himself, Nick Freeman, for driving while using the phone. And that's what happened with Alex Ferguson, I seem to remember, who was desperate to get to the toilet and he got away with it. So, you know,
was he ringing up to book the toilet in advance?
Yes, I imagine he was. Yes.
Well, and there was
Tell Pallister.
Yeah, pre-flush, warm the seat for me. No, Claudio Ranieri, the gentleman, finally hit the buffers at Watford after dropping into the bottom three with a defeat at home to Norwich, which featured that fancy little improvised flick you see from Josh Sargent. I like it when I see it, when there's a goal that I haven't seen before, you know, especially at my grizzled age. But it's really disrespectful to Norwich, don't you think? They win two games in a row, and it's the final straw for both defeated managers. You know, they're not that bad. I liked how the papers reprinted their headlines from earlier in the week or the week before, saying things like Ranieri on the brink, you know, to take credit for the most bleeding obvious thing they could have predicted. It's like reprinting your headline from the day before, sun to rise in the morning. Because any Watford manager has the job security of a Boris Johnson party planner, don't they? I mean, Roy Hodgson has got the job for the next 13 games or until the next international break, depending on which comes first, along with Ray Lewington, his old England sidekick.
And well, he's got history with Watford, you see.
Yeah, yes,
and
I'm
feeling a bit sorry for Harry the Hornet. Hodgson didn't like Harry the Hornet
for diving.
Harry the Hornet kept diving in a sort of satirical way. Pretending to be Zaha, and Hodgson got very baity about it.
Yeah,
you'd love to see a manager getting crossed with a mascot.
That's going to be a good meeting on the first day, isn't it?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I'm thinking. Yeah. Right,
watch out for Lewington crouching down behind him and Hodgson pushing him over.
No, I think Hodgson's going to come in and say, all right, change your mascot, change your fortune.
Change your luck.
That's what we want. And just said, we should move on to really, but another thing about managers, which I really like, did you see the Graham Potter interview? Because Graham Potter had been linked with Manchester United. Well, I say linked. Someone had said Graham Potter
Everton, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, no, I'll never be a sexy manager because my name's Potter.
And my
name's Graham, and I've got a long face and a ginger beard. And I just thought that was great. I thought that was such a lovely thing to say. And of course, he would be very popular at Stoke because he was an ex-player and his name's Potter. So I'd just like to say that we would love
to have him. Well, and then back in the Championship, I felt a bit sorry for Grant McCann, who got new broomed at Hull City by the new owners, wanting a fresh start, so on. He's got some very good results lately, hasn't he? In the last two he beat the team, beat Blackburn, who were third, and then away at Bournemouth, who were second. And they've been on the telly quite a bit. They were on against Stoke, weren't they?
They were against Everton.
I think I watched two of their games recently, and they looked decent, I thought. But they've been taken over by the Turkish Simon Cowell, apparently. Some concerns that he might try to bring in the Turkish Anton Dek as a new management team, Turkish David Williams as director of football. You know, whatever. When they play away at QPR next month, Grant McCann isn't going to London.
Turkey's got talent, by the way. Somewhere on the internet, there's a fantastic football juggler. You need to look that one up. I can't give it to you now, but it's out there. Grant McCann, and also, you know, here's a man who was doing well in the Championship, and they just sold Jared Bowen out from under.
They did, yeah.
When they were doing really, really well, and Jared Bowen was keeping them up, not single-handed, but was clearly their most effective player.
Yeah, he'd clearly make a difference. He's in fantastic form, isn't he, Jared Bowen?
Oh, he's great.
It's always interesting when someone gets linked with England and you think, I wonder if there's ever been a Jared before, you know, play for England. There might have been, like in the 1880s or something.
There's been one in Neighbours.
Other bits and bobs. Man City dropped points, didn't they, for the first time since October against Southampton. I'm pretty sure it was Gary Lineker who tweeted that Kyle Walker-Peters was the first player with Kyle Walker in his name to score against a team with Kyle Walker in it. And, you know, when you've got all those BBC stats people working away for you, that's the sort of thing, you know, that you get handed, isn't it? You know,
absolutely.
And so then Liverpool had to win to close the enormous gap a little bit, and they did at Crystal Palace, 3-1.
Yeah.
And in the end, I think everyone would probably think they're a little bit lucky with that late penalty decision when Diogo Jota collided with Vicente Guaita.
Yes, it was.
And
it
so
was,
more
it was
fucking VAR controversy.
Yeah,
you know, a lot. There have been a lot lately that seem to be winding people up. I mean, it's supposed to be a system that introduces factual certainty to situations. And it does with line calls, of course, you know, at the edge of the area and offsides. But and whether, you know, but when it comes to red cards and penalties, we're often left with the same sort of capricious and inexplicable decision making that we get from the match officials. And maybe that's because the bloke fucking up the VAR on a Sunday afternoon is the same bloke who fucked up on the pitch on Saturday. They're just the same people. I mean, referees as a breed, I think, you know, they seem to be a little bit weird. And I say this as someone whose grandfather was a referee. And I myself have a notoriously laissez-faire attitude to refereeing the match when I'm in charge of one. Because I find that if you give one free kick, suddenly you have to give 10, you know. Whereas if you establish early on that contact is okay, then generally people, you know, use common sense. But anyway, I wonder whether having one of these weirdos in charge of the VAR is telling another weirdo what to do and what to look at and call him over to the touchline and so on, isn't a bit of a missed opportunity. Because it's ex-players. Ex-players are often left saying that a referee doesn't really understand a situation because he's never played the game. He's only able to look at the fact that Harry Kane brushed the back of Thiago Silva without seeing that Thiago Silva knew it and knew he could get a free kick if he dived on his face. But what about making the VAR? Why does it have to be a referee? You know, it's, we all look at the television, we all know what we're seeing. Why not use a panel of ex-players like the old, like the pools panel? You know, because they would never have asked a referee to prognosticate on the result of a postponed game, would they? And there would be other benefits too. You could give Jermaine Genus the job and get him off the one show. You know, most nights, most nights it's football on. It would be football for him to do. But we're happy to listen, aren't we, on Match of the Day and so on, and on Sky, and to ex-players pontificating on these incidents. And you take their considered opinion as pretty much gospel, don't you? You know, if Danny Murphy says, oh, that was never a penalty, you kind of find it hard to disagree with him in a way that it's very easy to disagree with Paul Tierney, for instance. Yeah. You know? Put some players in charge. There's a huge pool to draw on as well, a huge pool of ex-players to draw on. So if someone fucks it up, you can sack them. The trouble with the referees is there's such a small pool. There's a small pool of like 15 Premier League referees. And so some of them are doing the game on Saturday. Some of them are the fourth officials at those games. Some of them are the VARs on those games. They don't have the capacity to sack someone who has a howler. You know, like the one on Sunday at Palace against Liverpool. You know, those people they can only afford to drop them for one game. They can only afford to move them for one game. You know, there's a small panel of elite referees and each one's more of a cracker barrel than the one before. Just get ex-players. There's hundreds of them. Hundreds of them trying to get back into the game somehow. And they know when they look at an incident, they know what the player's in. They can see what the player's intent was, for instance. You know, they can see. They're not looking at someone's foot meeting someone's ankle and the ankle turning over and thinking, well, that's definitely contact. That's definitely, it's players know he wasn't looking. And that was,
the sense of context is much different, I think, for the players than it is for a referee.
Yeah, I think so. And I think they should make use of that. You know, they should just make use of that.
Absolutely. Just a couple of things that I spotted. I saw that Andy Murray had been refusing millions of pounds to play in Saudi Arabia. And it's just occurred to me last week. This is starting to remind me of Sun City.
Do you remember when,
Sun City was the nightclub, wasn't it, in South Africa.
And so now
you've got the same deal in the Middle East with Qatar and Saudi and all those people in the role of
If you were abandoned, you played Sun City, you'd get shunned.
So you've got those countries in the role of the South African apartheid system, and David Beckham as Boney M, who famously broke that and did play Sun City, if I remember rightly. One other thing.
One of them lives in Streatham, you know. One of those lives around the corner. One of the ladies, lives around the corner.
Right. She's German.
I don't think she is. No, I think the man was German, the curly headed man.
Was he? That's lovely.
This lady, our friend Simon, fixed her fence.
Oh, good.
And then she wouldn't let him escape from her garden through her house. He had to climb over the fence he just fixed to get out.
Anyway. Yes. He's not Russia's greatest love machine, is he?
Simon isn't, definitely. Yeah. No.
Very quickly, the other things are, obviously there's been some incidents of things being thrown onto the pitch and that's all terrible. But what I did love was Steve Kavanagh, who's the CEO of Millwall, whose approach was, he's going to start a campaign at Millwall called "Don't be a tosser."
That'll work.
Unbelievable.
That will work.
And it reminded me of many years ago, I got approached by Stoke City Council, who said they wanted me to help them with their anti-littering campaign. And I said, well, why would you? And they said, you'll love this. This is what it's going
to
be.
Did you have to dress up as a squirrel?
No, no, there's going to be a bloke right on the poster, and he's got like chewing gum stuck.
Yeah.
To his foot.
Yeah.
Okay. And then there's going to be you with a speech bubble, and it's going to be, They think it's all over his shoe. That's the most terrible thing, almost as bad as don't be a tosser. And the final thing was that I love that Mohamed Salah had said about his contract that he hadn't been asking for crazy stuff.
For crazy stuff,
no. I was hoping it was a unicorn that he'd been asking
for. No, he's only quite reasonably asking for as much money a week as most people make in a lifetime.
Exactly.
Just one last thing, the turbulent bromance that is Tomelu Tuchel. Hit another rocky patch.
Yes.
Thomas picked on Romelu after the City game last week, humiliated him in front of everybody by saying he couldn't perform. And this week against Spurs, he seemed to be developing a full-blown barn door allergy. So now who knows what the future holds? Thomas is obviously hurting too. He said, "You sit on the bus and think, where are we going?" You know, I know what you mean, Thomas. You know, we've all sat on that relationship bus.
Yes. Okay, right. We're going to take a break now, and in a moment we will have our guest. Our guest today turned his passion for sport into his job and blazed the way for a change in the way sports people were represented both during and after their careers. He's represented England captains across at least four sports and seen his clients through good times and slightly more challenging times. He's also been hugely influential in the media, often creating whole new careers for his charges. In essence, over 30 years, he's created an environment where it's become more and more difficult for Chris and I to get any work. Welcome, John Holmes. Thank you, John. How are you, my friend?
Marvellous. How are
you? Very good to see you. Just before, you did mention a match that we went to with your son.
Yes.
Where I think I educated him in the ways of living in the jungle, did I not?
He was traumatised. He's never recovered
since. He's never recovered from it because...
You needed to defecate.
I needed to defecate,
The lose at the ground at Stoke, the Victoria ground, was so sufficiently hopeless that you felt the need to employ haberdashery.
I didn't know this was really you.
Did you? Yeah. So listen, if you're ever stuck in a place, this is just information that for the youngsters out there. If you're stuck in a place and there's no toilet paper, the best thing you can do is get your sock off, put your hand inside the sock, wipe your arse with the sock, turn it back inside out, bin the sock, and then you just spend the rest of the game with one sock on. This is what it was. Jack, was it?
Yes.
And I was Jack.
I'm sorry, I fainted for a moment there. What were you talking about?
He was interested to see that I only had one sock on, so I had to explain to him.
But you had a shit in your sock.
No, I had a shit in my sock. It was like a modern day Oedipus story.
the story
man with one sock.
Getting your pocket pissed into on the cop. Paled into...
That's why people used to buy a programme, wasn't it? So that they could make a funnel into pocket in front of them.
And then they made the programme all shiny.
Well, that makes it better.
It was far more effective, actually, but there you are.
Yeah. Anyway, John, so first of all, my initial description of you is as an agent. The world of agents has changed an awful lot since you first started. Is that the word you would use for yourself?
I suppose it is. I prefer to call myself a manager rather than an agent.
Or a head coach.
Strictly speaking, I think was probably right. When describing what I do to other people, I describe myself as a bit of a scuffler, really. I've done some cracking jobs in my life. You know, I've sold insurance. I've been a football club chairman. I've been a journalist. All the jobs that people love to hate.
So in a way, John, it was the insurance that got you in to being more significant in the lives of these players. You may well have been involved with them selling insurance, and then it moved on. So just tell me how it first started, because we're talking about the mid-70s here, aren't we?
I'm really old, Nick. I always wanted to be a journalist when I was at school and probably at university. And then one night I watched the Money programme, BBC Two, and it featured a man called Mark McCormack. And I watched this and I thought, wow, that's really cool. That's really clever. Mm-hmm. And so I got this idea in my head that maybe that was what I should do, but nobody did it over here, really. It was nothing. And certainly nobody did it in football.
Yep.
I after university, I did join the newspaper in Leicester, but I didn't really get on with the people and so on. And then there was a businessman in the town who I befriended, and I, you know, bullshitted with him about the ideas I got. And he said, I tell you what, I look after the football club in Leicester. Why don't you come and join me? I'll teach you a bit about insurance, savings, finance, and you can develop your ideas on sport with the players there. They had a star player at that point. They had one or two star players, actually. And not a bad side, early 70s, Leicester, with people like Weller and Worthington and people like that. But the one who was a real star was Peter Shilton. Mm-hmm. Started looking after Peter Shilton and tried a lot of ideas with him. He was a challenging client. I looked after him for 21 years. And as you know, he moved on. We did his transfer to Nottingham Forest.
And to Stoke.
Sorry?
And to Stoke. Yeah.
In the twilight of his career. Yeah.
Stoke was after Leicester.
But John, so it's quite funny because we had a link that we discovered much, much later there, because I know that that first negotiation you did with the Stoke board, and I think you showed your acumen and understanding of the human condition quite well. Just talk us through that final part of that. Yeah.
Alec Humphreys. We met them at a hotel in Northamptonshire. It was after an England game. The deputation from Stoke comprised the manager, Tony Waddington, lovely man, Alec Humphreys, your uncle or something, who was the director, and Billy Williams, who was the secretary. Tony Waddington started off by saying he'd signed lots of big players, which of course he had, and that they were going to pay him a couple of hundred quid a week, and that was it. And I said, well, no, that isn't it, really. We don't, that's not going to work. And he said, oh, right. Well, anyway, so I said, we're talking weeks. We're not doing that. We're talking years and we're talking annual salary. And what about the fringe benefits? And what about inflation? And what about this? What about that? And Tony began to look a little bit... he looked a bit nonplussed, and your uncle stepped in and he started saying...
Not my uncle, but go on.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, and the negotiations went on for 2 hours, and it was in the days when you had to get the forms to Lytham St Annes by 5 o'clock on a Thursday if they were going to play Saturday. Anyway... they were very keen that he played that Saturday. They were playing Wolves away, big game for Stoke, you know, local derby and that. And they were very keen. And Alec Humphreys, who was a big man, he was obviously a man who liked his trough. And he got nearer and nearer lunchtime. And he kept looking a bit twitchy. So he said, "Well, shall we have some?" I said, "No. We really need to get on with this. You know, we need to push it through because you've got the 5 o'clock deadline." And Billy Williams was there, going, "Yeah, I've got to drive up to Lytham St Annes, you know, in his Austin A40 or whatever it was." And anyway, to cut a long story short, we got inflation built into the contract. They bought his car for some outrageous sum of money, which sadly they later discovered wasn't quite the price that it was probably they could get on the open market for it. And we got the deal just about through, but he was bursting to get out of his trough. So he said, get the sandwiches up. So he got the sandwiches and he got a great big sandwich with prawns in it. And I said, look, this amount here, it comes to, because you're still doing it in weeks, it comes to £338.60 or something. I mean, this is silly. Can't we make it up to £350? And he was halfway through his sandwich and he went, you're not having any more. That's it. Anyway,
The reason that when we spoke about this later, that it amused me was because Alex Humphries' son was going out with my sister at the time. And I remember him getting this new car, thinking, that's a strange colour for a car. And sure enough, it was the car that you'd flogged him, the yellow something or other.
It was a Peugeot 505 with electric windows. It was brilliant. I think we sold it to Stoke for 4,000 quid. And he rang me up on the Monday. He said, you bastard, that car's only worth 1,500 quid. So I said, well, I did tell you that you could have the weekend to think about it.
Anyway,
and a test drive.
And a test drive,
of course. Yeah.
Now, just I wanted to move on a little bit, because obviously now, you know, you're very heavily involved in the media, and a lot of your clients, because you've got Lineker, you've got Gower, you've got Athers, I think, still, I don't know. At one stage you had Will Carling, you had four England captains, I think. But now, you know, you do an awful lot. I mean, Gary's clearly a colossus, you know, now in the media, and we still see David's back, which is a great, great thing. But is that what you think your expertise is now, is placing people later in their careers? That's number one. And secondly, if he was your client, would you have allowed Dion Dublin to do Homes Under the Hammer?
Listen, all I've done is hang around talented people. It's a bit like money. You never marry for money, you marry where money is. So if you're not very talented yourself, you hang around talented people, because they drop bits, don't they? Which is what I've been lucky enough to do during my career. And I mean, my passions were sport, particularly football, but I love all trad British sport, really. Football, cricket, rugby, you know, racing. I like the lot. Wasn't any good myself, but I just loved it. My dad was very keen. He took me to all sorts of sporting events when I was young, and I bought into it. And that, and I suppose television, were the great loves of my life, you know. And I always had this view that my original idea was that there was a programme, there wasn't much sport on the television in those days, but there was a programme called Sports View, which later became Sports Night with Coleman. Mm-hmm. And at university, I used to tell people, if you turn your TV on in 15 years, it's going to be Sports Night with Holmes. But so I had this sort of idea.
So Gary Lineker and the like are like avatars for you. They're like living out living vicariously through them. They're living your dream.
The conversation with Lineker went something like this. When he was about 24, 25, I was always like interested in them as people in long term, because the problem with sportsmen is, in general, their careers finish about 35. And then their lives are over, you know, for a lot of them.
Yeah, don't tell them that.
That's the end. But I said to Gary one day, I said, what would you have done if you hadn't been a footballer? And like the smart arse he is, he said, I'd have been a cricketer. So I said, OK, I've broken both your legs now. What are you going to do? And he said, I'd like to have been a journalist, a sports journalist, but I can't do that, can I? So I said, why? So he said, well, I'm not trained. I said, listen, I've been a journalist. You know what the training is the first morning? Any journalist, the only thing they ever do is they get given the sheet, and the senior journalist comes to them and teaches them how to fiddle their expenses. That's what a journalist training is. So you can do that. And I said to him, hang around the journalists, see what they do, take every opportunity to get interviewed, learn it from outside, and then when you finish, we'll do it. And we sort of he did every interview he could, he hung around, he did all sorts of things. You know, he grumbled like hell, I made him write his own pieces and so on for a newspaper. But of course, it was all training that he could do and be paid for it.
Do you give your clients any kind of training for television work? Is there like presenter camp that they can go to,
radio is the best camp.
Radio,
you get loads and loads of hours. Des Lynam started on radio, didn't he?
Jim
Rosenthal started on radio. Lots and lots of them started on radio. It's different, but what you get on radio is, first of all, it's not as exposing as television, so you can can make a few mistakes. You get loads of hours, listen to yourself back, work out the things that you said that worked, the things that didn't work. You know, you're a great advantage being on the radio.
You, well, and now, nowadays you can do podcasts and you can say what you like and no one listening at all.
This is the millions out there, of course, as we know. And do as many different things and appear in different scenarios, even, you know, appear on quiz shows with dubious presenters from Stoke-on-Trent.
Settle down.
And the first time I met both of you, there was a play called An Evening with Gary Lineker, and I saw it at the South Bank. You both appeared in that. And of course, that gave us an idea. And later, I'd always had this idea that Question of Sport drove me mad. I just thought it was such a patronising, silly programme that it drove me mad. And I wanted to do something that was really more about the humour in sport and so on. And then they said, they tried umpteen people as a presenter, and then in the end they said, well, we've got this bloke called Nick Hancock. He's been in. I said, I know what he's been in. I've seen him on stage. No wonder he's trying to be a presenter. I think it's all over started, which of course taught Gary, he was sitting next to comedians, and he learnt how to deliver a joke, which was interesting.
When's he going to start using that? The thing I like about Gary Lineker is on Match of the Day is when he signs off, he seems to have developed almost a genre of jokes that's entirely his, you know, almost it's the sort of joke that no one else would do. I mean, the one that really sticks in my mind is when Norwich beat Man City, and he said, so how do you beat Man City? Fark knows, and Fark was the manager of Norwich.
Yes, he signed off.
Fark knows, and I thought, do you know what? No one else could do that joke. It's not a question of getting away with it, you know, because he clearly gets away with it because he's charming and funny and so on. But no one else would even try that joke. You know?
I think it's all over was very important because the complaint that people had about him when he was a player was, oh, he's very bland, he never says anything, this sort of thing. So I thought going on to Think It's All Over, which I was warned against, incidentally, Jonathan Martin, who was head of BBC Sport at that point, when I was talking to him about both Gower and Lineker going onto the BBC, he said, one thing I should really warn you again is doing anything that might be deemed, have I got sport for you? And I said, oh, yeah. And in the meantime, I was working on that idea, and Think It's All Over was originally a radio quiz chaired by Des Lynam, who, interestingly, Des did not think it would work on TV. I did, and I'd seen the pilot. I provided I think Gower and Carling were on the pilot. Gary was in Japan at the time, and then when it came to TV, the idea was taken onto TV, I was really keen to push both of them to do it. They were preeminent. That only really worked because they were really good at sport. The mistake the producers made later was they tried to use people who weren't as good. The jokes about Gary only worked because he was very good. The jokes about Gower only worked because he was very good. If they weren't very good, it wouldn't have worked.
And I think, John, and we won't dwell on this for too long, the really good thing for us was it gave us permission to do nearly anything. Because any sportsman watching would go, if Gary Lineker and David Gower are willing to laugh at themselves, we should be willing to laugh at ourselves.
And it would have been a different animal, don't you think, if Desmond Lynam had done it. It would have been a closer cousin to Question of Sport. It would have been, or if Motson had done it or someone like that, someone out of the sport department had done it.
I mean, Motty did do Think It's All Over, but that's another story. That was a nightmare, wasn't it? Curtis Michael went on I think it was Colin Montgomery went in and obviously hadn't been told or never watched it, and said they're taking the piss out of me. What are they doing? I can't take this. You going?
The interesting thing about that, John, and we'll move on from this, but the interesting thing about that is that, of course, sports people that play in teams are much better at having the piss taken out of them because they have the piss taken out of them all the time. Whereas the individuals are not used to that. You know, they live in their own world. It's not that they're precious, they're just not used to it. It doesn't happen.
It's the dressing room banter. I remember a conversation with Gower and his financial advisor a few years ago, and they were having a meeting, and the advisor, I said to the advisor, you want me in on the meeting? And he said, well, I'm not really sure. So I said, oh, really? Because Gower, on the whole, it's better if I'm there. He said, well, in the last meeting, you told him he was a fucking idiot. So I said, yeah. So he said, well, that was a bit rude. So I said, hold on a second, got Gower on the phone. Get Gower on the phone. Gower, listen, I'm with Vince at the moment, and he's a bit worried about me coming in the meeting because I called you a fucking idiot. He said, well, you've been doing that for the last 20 years. Why? Yeah.
So it's in the job description.
They are. It's more of the banter of the dressing room. And you're right. I find it's more difficult with individual sport. They're far more precious. When you go into a dressing room, it is. There's the banter and the backwards and forwards. And team sportsmen tend to be different. Yeah.
And just to move back to sort of to the contemporary game and things like that. I mean, what are your views, if you have any, and I'm sure you will, on the way the agents operate now? I mean, is it a source of regret, embarrassment? Is it a good thing? Is it something you wouldn't feel comfortable in? I mean, it's a different thing to flogging Peter Shilton's car to a man who wants his lunch, isn't it, these days?
It's completely different. It's completely wrong. To be honest, what happened was, what should have happened was that they followed the American example, where the guys who are agents actually represent the sportsmen. They don't represent the clubs. What has happened is there was another European tradition, and this basically came in football because it started with players coming from behind the Iron Curtain. They came to countries the other side of the Iron Curtain where they weren't allowed out. If you remember the Eastern European footballers and so on, they all played for military or police teams or what have you, and they weren't supposed to be out till they're 28. So the only way they got out was by getting somebody to bribe somebody. So these agents were used as, they were quite often emigres from the communist regimes with connections back in there who went back. And there was a big tradition of this in Germany. The clubs used to hire these guys to go to the Czech players or the Yugoslav players and so on, bribe the official. So they got out before they were 28.
Yeah. So in effect, what's happened is that now agents can work both ends, can't they?
Yeah, and they get paid by both sides, and it's completely wrong. My view is an agent should only be allowed to represent the player and get paid by the player. And therefore, his interests are solely focused on promoting the player, not getting paid off by the club to sign some rubbishy contract.
Yeah. I just wanted to ask you also, because you are a fan, and I know you're a fan. I see you at all sorts of sporting events. Yeah. You know, you and I both, because we've got no friends, quite often on our own, watching things. But I just wanted to put something out to you, which we've talked about quite a lot over the weeks here, which is the idea, which may be anathema, I don't know, the idea that there should be a more moral element to some of the things that are happening in football. I worry about the World Cup in Qatar. I worry about the Saudi thing with Newcastle. I worry about a lot of stuff where football, I worry about FIFA, but not for anything else, where football tries to pretend that anything goes because sport and so-called politics don't mix. I'm interested to know what you think as a fan. Is that disquieting? Is it upsetting? Is it worrying?
Of course it is. You know, we become sports fans when we're kids, don't we? We're taken to games when we're 6, 7, 8 years old, and we fall in love with it, and we fall in love with the heroes and stuff like that. And it's a fantastic thing in most people's of our generation's lives, going to the football. And in my particular case, it meant I had an identity, as it were. I was Leicester. Yeah. You know, it gave me a connection with the town and the city and everything. And I've always felt they are my club. I shall be Leicester till I die. I went to the funeral of a friend of mine a couple of weeks back, and I'd known him since I was 12, 13 years old, and he was a Leicester fan. And at the funeral, you know, they told stories about him all the way through his life that were connected with the football club, and the crest was up there, and he clearly, next to his family, that meant the most to him in his life. And we do. It gives us an identity. And then comes a period when you realise, you know, the players, how many of them really care about the clubs? They move on and all that. Then you get more involved, as I did, and you realise a lot of it is really, really pretty horrid. Now we've got a situation where we've got a lot of owners. They don't even go and watch their clubs. You know, they're not even there. They're using it for other purposes. And they're taking the fans, really, for a ride, which is very sad, because a club used correctly, you know, it does represent the town. The town improves. Nottingham had a brilliant period when Clough was manager. Everyone knew who you were if you were a Forest fan at that point round the world. Now you go anywhere. And Leicester, because of the exploits of winning the league when they did, and they had a good season in Europe the following season, wherever go, people talk about the Foxes and Leicester, and actually the city has benefited as a result terrifically.
I've said on this show before, I think there should be 6 points available in the Premier League for each owner who has to go into a sports quiz. And they have to answer questions about the history of football. I think that would even it up a little bit, don't you?
It would even it up a little bit. I mean, as you say, you know, if owners are not coming to games and not showing their faces and not participating in the club as a community asset, as a community artefact, you know, then they clearly have another agenda. They clearly have something else that they want to get out of it, that is maybe elusive from the outside. You can't see what it is that Saudi Arabia are getting out of owning Newcastle. You know, the phrase sports washing was used to try and somehow polish up their international reputation because their human rights record is so bad. How Newcastle does that for them, I don't quite grasp what they're getting out of it, but they're not. It's like Mohammed bin Salman, for instance, is supposedly the figurehead of Saudi Arabia, but also of this fund that owns Newcastle, and he's not the one coming to games. He's not. How is the, you know, any number of Newcastle fans wearing tea towels on the head doesn't bring him into that community? Doesn't make him part of the fabric of that club?
Joe Lewis owns Tottenham and very rarely goes to games. The Glazers very rarely go to games.
Stan Kroenke.
In the old days, the owner of the football club, you know, was the mill owner. He was a local businessman. And the managers always got the sack when the owner went to his golf club on Sunday morning and the others took the piss out of him. And he had to walk around the town. When they were doing well, everyone wanted to know him. And when they were doing badly, everyone laughed at him. So
it used to be a brewery that owned Oldham. It used to be a brewery, and they had to give it up because they couldn't organise, you know, a proverbial.
Lees. Anyway, yeah, that's right. Lees. Funny, we were early before you came on, John. We were talking about Bill Kenwright and saying, you know, how appalling the way that people are treating him when he clearly is a supporter of Everton Football Club. He clearly does go to all the games. He clearly does get upset when they're not doing well.
And he's doing everything in his power to make things better there. You know, however that's going, there's no blame to place there, you know.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, it's probably better if the CEO can be a bit dispassionate and not be a total supporter. Because the problem is, it's like with football is very emotional. We're all of us emotional about our clubs. You know, I always said to people, the best thing to be in football actually is a supporter. Because what you can do, if they lose or they play badly, you say, I hate them all. They're useless. They should all get the effing sack. I'll go home, kick the dog, have a couple of pints, watch Casualty, but I'll go back next week, won't I? You know, we all go back next week. We are addicted in that sense. And it's got to the stage now where actually the fans don't really care about the owners. All they want is their money. You know, I can remember becoming chairman at Leicester and people said, oh, it must be great. And I said, no, it's not. It's awful. Because all you do is all week, you worry even more about the result than you do normally, except when you go on Saturday, the manager wants two new players. The box holders are complaining about the standard of sausages. You know, there's all sorts of things that are going on. And you've got to be nice to the opposition chair. And he might be someone like Ken Bates, who you feel like hitting in the face. And then at the end of the game, if you've lost, you've got to go, well played, you deserve to win. No, you didn't, you cheating bastards. That's what a fan.
That's the problem with the supporter chairman, yeah.
So being a chairman is no good. And I encourage my kids to start chants of get your money out because of that. That way, you know, I could say, I haven't got any money. You've got it all. It's gone.
Well, I think we're going to leave there because that was a fantastic bit of raw emotion. And also, I can see that you need to go because you started to take your socks off. John, thank you so much. It's been wonderful having you on the show. We'll be back next week. Don't forget, you can always listen to any of the back episodes because, quite frankly, this podcast can be getting worse and worse and worse each time we put it out.
Yeah, so some of the good ones. Weeks ago,
weeks and weeks ago. Well, apart from today's John, obviously. Sorry, I didn't know he was still there. Someone should have told me he was still here. John Holmes, thank you so much.
John.
Thanks, John.
Sports Social Podcast Network.